Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Matot. This week, Rabbi Daniel Roth discusses Matot. Rabbi Daniel Roth is a member of the Pardes faculty. He also serves as the director of the Pardes Advanced Scholars Program, the Kollel, and he is the coordinator and a faculty member for the Pardes Peace and Conflict Track. And now, Rabbi Daniel Roth.
Thank you, Larry. As director of the Pardes Peace and Conflict Track, which focuses on the study of Judaism and conflict resolution, I'm always very interested in the analysis of biblical conflicts and their possible relevance for conflicts in our society today. In this week's parsha, Parshat Matot, like so many other parshas, there is a very serious internal conflict within B'nai Israel. However, this time, unlike so many of the other stories, especially in Sefer Bamidbar, in the book of Numbers, which described destructive conflicts, here there is perhaps finally an example of a constructive conflict, a conflict that may be defined as a machloket l'shem shamayim, a conflict for the sake of heaven. The conflict I'm referring to in Parshat Matot is that between the tribes of Reuven and Gad on the one hand, and Moshe and the other heads of the tribes on the other hand. I encourage you to follow along with the Chumash and open up to Bamidbar or Numbers chapter 32. I'd like to explore the following questions. How was the conflict initially defined? How is it resolved? What may have happened if the conflict was not resolved as it was? And what can we learn from the management of this conflict to conflicts in our society today? So when we open up the story and begin, we see that the conflict is initially described in a very position-oriented manner. Each side stuck in their position. Reuven and Gad's position, on the one hand, is they don't want to go up to the land of Israel. They want to stay on the eastern bank. As they say in verse 5 of chapter 32, don't make us pass over the Jordan. We want to stay on the other side. Moshe's position, on the other hand, is the exact opposite, is that all of B'nai Israel must go up into the land of Israel. And any attempt not to do so is a clear act of rebellion. Moshe has, after all, just spent the last 40 years trying to make sure that all goes smoothly and so that all of B'nai Israel can finally enter into the promised land. How many times has he heard the people rebel and say they don't want to go into the land? What's scariest for him is that Reuven and Gad's demands that they don't want to go up sound to Moshe just like the demands, or I should say positions, of the 10 spies some 40 years earlier when they were sent into the land and came back and told how they don't want to go up and then disheartened everyone else from not wanting to go up as well. Moshe interprets this conflict as the exact same conflict that had been with the spies, again, in Bamidbar chapter 13. If you take a look here in chapter 32, from verses 6 to verses 15, you see Moshe's initial response to Reuven and Gad's request that they not have to go into the land of Israel. I'll just take a look at a couple of the verses. If you look at verse 8, for example. Thus did your fathers, when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. For when they went up into the valley of Eshkol and saw the land, they turned away the heart of the children of Israel, that they should not go into the land which Hashem has given them. You are just like them, he says. Right? And we all know what happened. The 10 spies came back, gave their critical report, and convinced all of the people that this was not a good plan. And as a result, Hashem got upset and decreed upon them 40 years of wandering in the desert. And then Moshe concludes and says, and behold, you have risen up to be just like your father instead. So this accusation is extremely serious. Moshe sees here the potential for another mass rebellion, which may result in all the people again being stuck in the desert for a whole other generation, another 40 years. This is pretty scary. At this moment, the conflict can derail and become an extremely destructive conflict. The tribes of Reuben and Gad could respond to Moshe's rebuke, or perhaps attack, by attacking back in a defensive way, perhaps attacking Moshe personally, claiming that he's, after all, the failed leader that didn't succeed in bringing the people into the land of Israel, or that he promised them a land that was not really as good as he had said it would be. After all, it doesn't have the same kind of land that's on the eastern bank that they can use for pasturing their mass amounts of flock. They could have turned the conflict into that way, right? However, instead, they respond with a proposal that moves the two conflicting parties from what we would call position-oriented thinking into focusing on their conflicting needs. Our needs, as they might say, is to have land for our livestock to pasture in. And this is on the eastern side of the Jordan. They're not criticizing the land of Israel here. They also relate to what they understand to be Moshe's need, which is not to dishearten the rest of the Israelites. And they offer a creative idea, which is to go in front of the battle, to be the first ones into battle, and help the other tribes conquer their inheritance in the land. And only afterwards do they go back to the eastern bank and settle properly their tribe. It's at this moment when they can talk about their own needs and recognize the needs of the other side, even though they might seem to be in conflict, and they had just been harshly rebuked, that there is a transformation of the conflict from a potentially destructive conflict to being a constructive conflict, again, what we would call, in rabbinic terminology, a machlok l'shem shemayim, a conflict for the sake of heaven. However, the conflict is still not over when two parties can recognize their own needs and their other side's needs. But rather, there's also the need to think in terms of creative solutions for how to ensure that creative solutions actually be implemented. And here there's a need to reach a kind of agreement that will be a binding agreement and entirely unambiguous. Okay, something very much stressed when you come to, let's say, in mediation, you come to an agreement between two different parties, you have to be extremely careful in the wording of it so that nobody later on goes ahead and misinterprets. And while it sometimes might be faster to come to an agreement by leaving things ambiguous, it ultimately does not succeed in being implemented. Therefore, Moshe goes ahead and repeats back the agreement in clear language to Reuven and Gad first, and they repeat back to him exactly how they understood it, so that their both sides are on the same page. And then again, Moshe orders or tells over the whole agreement to the future leaders that will be in charge of Bnei Israel after Moshe is no longer there, so that they too are party to the understanding and to the agreement, and again, Reuven and Gad commit to them as well. Moshe also introduces here what is known in rabbinic law as a tnai kaful, or a double stipulation. And that means not only what happens if all goes well, but also to put into the agreement what happens if one party breaches the agreement. And here he says, I'm looking in chapter 32, verse 30, right? Ve'im lo ya'avru chalutzim itchem, v'no'achazu betochachem be'eretz Kenan. In English, but if they will not pass over with you armed, they shall have possessions among you in the land of Canaan. Here Moshe is talking to the future heads of Bnei Israel that are going to be taking his place when he's no longer there, and saying, listen, this is what happens if they cross over right now and they take part in the battle and lead in the battle, then they get to inherit. And if they don't, then what happens? they are going to all have to move into the land of Canaan, and you'll find them a place. The commentaries expand upon this a little bit more to make it even sharper in terms of what happens if they don't keep their side of the agreement. The Ramban, for example, explains that when they were allowed to stay, or their families and cattle were allowed to stay in the interim, at the time, over the years, that the men went over to battle in the land of Canaan, they were only given just a very, very small place to hold their cattle, to keep their families, but they were not actually given over the land that they would be able to use to settle. And this was a negotiating tactic that Moshe used in order that it's not that you gave over all the goods already, but that they were sort of in like a temporary camp waiting, that they would only be able to inherit their land after everyone else had inherited, because they had asked for this kind of exceptional case of where they wanted to inherit. The Ibn Ezra also explains, and the Ramban brings him here, that it was very clearly stated that the implications would be that if they did not go ahead and fight, that they all would actually be forcefully transferred, expelled out of the eastern bank, and forcefully brought back to their homes in the western bank, or in the rest of the land of Canaan. It's interesting to note that Reuven and Gad repeat back the agreement here, again, at the end of, right after verse 31, 32, but they don't use the double stipulation. They just say, this is what we're going to do, but they don't say what's going to happen if we don't do it. And here the Ramban explains that they felt perhaps a little bit slighted that Moshe needed to use this double stipulation, this Tanai Kaful, and said, how could, you know, you can trust us, you don't need to do it, but here is an example of even after there has been good faith and there has been a negotiated agreement that meets both parties' needs, conflicting needs, still sometimes there can be moments where how much do we really want to fill in the ambiguity? How much do we want to talk about what happens if the agreement doesn't work out? Nevertheless, it's clear they've demonstrated how there can be potential for conflict, how there were different positions initially, how they explored what the needs and concerns were of the different sides, and they were able to reach an agreement that was binding and succeeded in bringing about what we would call a win-win situation. We are later told in the book of Joshua, chapter 22, that the deal succeeds, and that Reuven and Gad, sure enough, did go out and fight in front of all the people, kept their side of the bargain, and were allowed to therefore go back to their homes in the eastern bank. But this isn't the end of the relationship. This isn't even the end of the conflict. At the exact moment that they go back home, the first thing they do upon arriving there is they build this huge altar right off of the Jordan. This raises the suspicions of the Israelites. And the head of the Israelites, the high priest at the time, Pinchas, and they see this as a potential act of rebellion. Building an altar is a sign of perhaps a competing theology, another altar that's going to compete with the one altar that's supposed to unite all of Bnei Israel that is at the time housed in Shiloh, and later to be moved, of course, to Jerusalem. We learn from this that even if one conflict can be negotiated, there can still be another one right around the corner that can again bring about mistrust between the sides. But here, again, the sides are able to transform the conflict into being constructive through direct dialogue and people understanding where things are actually at. And the people of Reuben and Gad respond, they say, Chalila. It's not that we were trying to rebel. That was not our intention at all. It was the opposite. We built this altar that we will intentionally not bring sacrifices to it, not use it for purpose of worship, in order that our children and our children's children will remember that the only real place of worship for us is with you on the other side of the Jordan. And therefore, it's actually a sign of unity. And here, it's just amazing how the exact sign from their intention, from Reuben and God's intention, of unity was potentially perceived as a sign of conflict and rebellion. But again, they were able to clear up their misunderstanding and transform their potential conflict or keeping their conflict in a place of machlok l'shem shamayim, with sometimes differences or ideas that are for the sake of heaven, and have constructive dialogue. This is all very different from, of course, what happened between Moshe and the spies some 40 years earlier. That conflict can clearly be described as a destructive conflict, a machloket lo l'shem shamayim. Each started its view not taking into account the needs and values of the other side. On the one hand, Caleb and Moshe, who want to go into the land and not rebel against God because they feel a need to fulfill, right, the promises and the vision that had been set out when they left Egypt. On the other hand, the spies feel a need to be, quote unquote, realistic, and perhaps are unclear about how involved Hashem will be in the battles once they enter into land. I mean, they know that there will no longer be the special miraculous food of the manna, right? They know that there will not be the pillar of fire and the clouds of glory. So what will there be, right? And their people are kind of unclear, perhaps, when the spies go in, that it seems to be a realistic attempt to see what's happening in the land of Israel, in the land of Canaan. It's unclear to them, is this going to be the way Hashem fought the battles in Egypt? Through miracles? Or is this going to be, quote-unquote, again, in the real world, where there are real dangers, and we have to be responsible for what the odds are in any given political situation? The two sides, however, don't discuss their conflicting concerns and needs, but rather there's a sense of delegitimizing the other side. This all results in, of course, 40 years of the people literally being stuck in the desert. And the question that should be explored is, what could have happened? What could have happened if the spies sat and talked with each other before giving their conflicting reports in an open sense of a machlok l'shem shamayim, a constructive dialogue? What could have happened if they had had that conversation in Moshe as well? Could they have been able to succeed in recognizing that they both cared deeply about the welfare of Bnei Israel, the Jewish people, but see how to go about looking after the people in very, very different ways, in opposite ways? Perhaps they could have been able to clarify together the ambiguous question of how miraculous will the events be once they cross over into the land. Again, to what extent will it be the real world or a miraculous world? Such an exercise of how a healthy discussion, a dialogue between the spies themselves and between the spies and Moshe could have looked is actually something that we're doing, that we started this last Wednesday in the summer course of the Peace and Conflict track, and we're continuing this afternoon. What we did is we did something that we call a chavruta role-playing, where each chavruta had to pretend that they were one of the spies, specifically Caleb on the one hand, and Galia, sort of the feminine Yigal, on the other hand. And they had to who were two people visiting the land of Israel for 3 weeks and then experiencing very, very different trips to the land of Israel. One very positive and feeling very connected, and the other much more critical and negative. And the challenge was for the students to role play these the spies, using a communication agreement, using communication skills for how we can have a machlok l'shem shamayim, to disagree but yet feel close in relationship and understand, and then come back with a presentation, a joint presentation for their home shul of Temple Adat B'nai Yisrael. Again, a play on of chapter 13. And the goal was, how can we practice turning such destructive conflicts, as is in the story of the spies, into being more constructive? How can we do that not only as a textual exercise, but also for how Jews might perceive Israel today in very different ways? So this exercise is, again, very important in a learning environment where we study text and conflict transformation, but it's also, or even more important, for what actually is happening with the major internal conflicts facing the Jewish people today. In this last week, we open up the newspapers. There were so many internal conflicts within the Jewish people. I mean, everything from mass riots in the area of Mea Shearim, over roads being opened or closed, even destructive conflicts over the doctors' strike that some people might be aware of, but doctors have been on strike in Israel for over a few months. And there has been a strong, of course, internal conflict over this new boycott law. Here we have two sides deeply entrenched in their positions. Each side sees the other side as undermining perhaps the identity and security of not only the state of Israel, but also of the Jewish people in general. One raising perhaps the slogan that the other side is anti-democratic, and while the other raising the flag of you're anti-Jewish or anti-Zionist. Each side, however, there's a feeling that I experience, at least, that the other side is delegitimized, perhaps even dehumanized, in the other side, in the eyes of the other, not with no understanding of the needs or values of the other side. Passing laws or running to high courts to bypass those laws, and then again legislation to bypass the high court. This is a classic example of unilateral ways of trying to resolve conflict, which is otherwise known as part of the definition of a destructive conflict. Destructive conflict is when we try to resolve a conflict by promoting our position without taking into account at all the other side's needs or values. It is this exact opposite, are the examples of trying to resolve conflicts without having to take, again, into account each side. What would it look like for the different sides in this conflict, for example? Both the politicians, the spiritual leaders, the lay leaders, the artists, the rabbis, to really try to understand the needs and values and interpretations of the other side. For each side to understand that the other side also sees their conflict as being L'shem Shemayim, as being a legitimate conflict, as being a legitimate position. What do the right wing, who wanted to pass this law, actually want? Perhaps what they're trying to achieve was to stop the boycotts and the delegitimization of Israel. What is the left wing, who are demonstrating and trying to cancel this law? What is it that they want? What are their needs? And perhaps what they're trying also is to stop the delegitimization of Israel. The bait, however, is how to stop it. Through the openness of freedom of speech, or is it going to be through means of legislation? The debate is also over, should a distinction be made between the West Bank and between the rest of Israel? The left may feel that by boycotting the West Bank, they actually are succeeding legitimizing the rest of Israel, while the right may feel that this is ultimately delegitimizing everybody. I'm not here to try to get into the political debate or to answer how such an alternative dialogue would actually look within Israel or within the Jewish people, but it would include perhaps changing the frame of language from blaming statements and critical statements of you do this or don't do that to statements of these are how I see these things, these are my needs. From criticizing to speaking about our needs and recognizing the other side's needs as legitimate as well. I'd like to conclude with an insight of the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Lodz in 19th century, who in his interpretation on the conflict between Reuben and Gad on the one hand and the rest of the tribes on the other. The Netziv explains that it was not enough for the two sides in conflict to just simply negotiate their needs and come to a rational win-win solution, but there was a need to ensure basic common values and the continued personal relationship of the two sides. And this was achieved by Moshe deciding to split the tribe of Manasseh into two parts. One was to be located on the western side, in land of Canaan with all the rest of the tribes, and the other half was to be relocated to the eastern side. And these people did it out of their own will, and they were considered, according to the Netziv, to be Torah scholars that increased peace in the world. And this way, they were able to continue to preserve the personal connections between the two sides of the Jordan River, and to continue to base these relationships on some sort of shared values. And this was necessary for helping the two sides perhaps overcome not only the current conflict over the moment of inheriting the land, but also perhaps future conflicts. And I think here, the question that I'd like to leave us with here is, who are the two halves of the tribes of Manasseh today, striving to keep the Jewish people's conflicts, or people in general's conflicts in this world, in a constructive L'shem Shamayim framework? Can we be those people on both sides of the banks, going back and forth, explaining to the other side what's happening, therefore transforming or at least keeping machlokot, conflicts, into being L'shem Shamayim constructive? Thank you very much, and Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Roth. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so please send an email to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.